The opening plenary is on the topic of Towards a Europe of Sanctuary. And we've got an extraordinary and inspiring group of people with reflections and experiences of mobilising civil society in different parts of Europe. I think for the reasons that you've heard from Bob and in the opening remarks, it would be very easy to be pessimistic, to despair in the face of seemingly insurmountable challenges, of border closures, of too many people, including children, drowning in the Aegean Sea, of the lack of leadership by politicians and people who should be able to take responsibility and offer moral guidance. But I think all of the people on this panel, like so many people, offer us a reason for hope. I think one of the things that struck me during the first summer of the so-called refugee crisis was the movement and mobilisation of civil society, the desire to shape the public in a context where refugee issues have had more attention by the media and politicians than perhaps ever before in Europe. And there are many examples of inspiring initiatives from civil society. And so I want to keep this panel quite interactive, but to begin, just to tell you a bit about the extraordinary people that we've got on this panel, to contextualise where they come from. I want to say a bit about each of them. And I apologise in each case if I massacre the pronunciation of their names, but I'll do my best. To my right is Brindish Bjergvindsdottir. And Brindish has started an initiative called Syria is Calling. And it began on the 30th of August 2015 with a Facebook event called Syria is Calling and an open letter that Brindish wrote to the Minister of Social Affairs and Housing. And the premise for that letter was that up to that point, the country had agreed to admit some 50 Syrian refugees through resettlement onto Icelandic territory. And Brindish wrote and said she was prepared to personally pay for and support an extra five refugees. And she published that open letter as an author and folklorist of significant reputation in Iceland, somebody who's won the Icelandic Literary Prize and the Icelandic Children's Book Prize. And in that letter, she wrote, amongst other things, the following. Refugees are human resources. They have experience and skills. Refugees are our future spouses, best friends, or soulmates. The drummer for the band of our children. Our next colleague, Miss Iceland in 2022. The carpenter who finally finished the bathroom. The cook in the cafeteria. The computer games genius, or the television host. And that inspired, in the matter of a few days, some 12,000 people to come forwards, offering to host and sponsor the resettlement of Syrian refugees. So Brindish, in a short space of time, transformed Icelandic refugee policy. To my immediate left, two other people have similarly initiated what can be described, I think, as a social enterprise. Jonas Kokoschka and Marijke Geiling created Flüchtlinge Willkommen, Refugees Welcome in Germany. They started it in December 2014, having had their own experience of hosting refugees in their home. And since then, I think it would be fair to say it's become the Airbnb of the refugee space. They have offices in Berlin, Hamburg, Leipzig, Munich. And they've been able to promote a social movement in which many Germans have opened up their homes to refugees and others across Europe have taken inspiration. Finally, to my far left is Sabir Zazai, who is himself a refugee, a former refugee of Afghan origin. And Sabir is somebody who was supported by an organisation in Coventry called the Refugee and Migrant Centre. But today he's the director of that centre, having done his own research and undertaken study on asylum policies in the UK, he's made it his mission to in turn support other refugees, asylum seekers and migrants coming to the United Kingdom. So we have four extremely inspiring people with stories to tell. And before we get into an interactive conversation, I want to give them each a short period of time, just 5 minutes or so, to tell you a bit about their stories and what they've done. So, I can start with you.
Do you want me off there, or...?
Wherever you're most comfortable. If you're here, happy here, that would be great.
Okay. Dear everyone, thank you so much for inviting me overseas from Reykjavik. It's a great honor to be allowed to participate in this conference and get a chance to listen to and learn from other speakers this weekend, bring valuable new knowledge back home with me. I come from Iceland, where I've been working on changing government policy regarding refugees and asylum seekers. Iceland has a population of roughly 300,000 people, indeed well within the total population of Cornwall. Government policy in the affairs of refugees and asylum seekers has up to this day been very conservative, which may both be traced to concerns about the small population as well as a traditional national identity that insists on how unique Iceland and its culture supposedly are. These points of view are then paraded as arguments against immigration rather than as good reasons to introduce Icelandic culture and language to other people and thereby involving ever more people that speak Icelandic and take part in its culture. A case in point would be the occupation of the US Army in 1945 when Icelandic officials refused to allow African-American soldiers in the country, arguing that Icelanders would be too shocked at seeing people that looked different from themselves. This refusal was ignored by the US Army some decades later. Iceland has received fewer refugees and asylum seekers per capita than any of the neighbouring countries. Luckily, I was afforded the chance to study in Canada as an exchange student during my undergraduates. That is where I first experienced a positive political attitude towards immigrants at the age of 23. I was watching TV when, to my surprise, an advertisement from the Canadian government was shown, expressing sincere gratitude to these two immigrants for choosing Canada and thereby contributing their efforts, their knowledge, their culture and language to the country. So, last year, when photos of drowned Syrian refugees started to appear in Icelandic media, me and a friend of mine got sick of thinking that our only chance for action was text messaging UNICEF. At the same time, news reported that the Icelandic government would only welcome 50 refugees from Syria over a period of the next 2 years. As a teacher at the Icelandic University of the Arts, I have learned that instead of producing more stuff, today's product designers aspire to improve the actual processes of making stuff, making the production more efficient, more sustainable, more safe, more simple. Inspired by this thinking about the processes themselves, I ask myself why the process of welcoming refugees to Iceland would have to take so long and include so few. I wanted to improve this process just as we improve other processes in the modern world without even giving it much thought, for an example when it comes to technology, our phones and stuff. I created an event on Facebook called Dear Eygló Harðar, Syria Calling, Eygló Harðar being the Minister for Social Affairs and Housing. On the page of the event, people could write a letter addressed to Eygló and volunteer anything they could think of to aid the Syrian refugees. By this, I hope to demonstrate that Iceland was fit to welcome way more than 50 people in a much shorter period of time than 2 years. The response was immense. People volunteered housing, food, language, classes, translation, anything they believed to be of help. To me, this platform represented three valuable aspects. First of all, I made an effort to talk in a positive and just manner about refugees in much the same way I had seen done on the Canadian television. Secondly, I wanted to create pressure on the government. I wanted to see the media demanding Minister Eygló about why so few people were coming and why it should take so long. I hoped such pressure would lead to a better process of welcoming refugees. Thirdly, Syria Calling was supposed to be an action both symbolic and practical. It became symbolic by the participation and volunteering of so many people, even though it would be impossible to actualize everything people were volunteering, the action still demonstrated a good will to contribute to the cause, a will that Icelandic politicians could not dismiss. It was also practical as so many people ended up signing up for more direct action with organizations such as the Red Cross, where, for an example, 1,700 new volunteers stood in some 24 hours in the wake of the project. Today, people often ask me if the government decided to accept more than 50 refugees. That did not happen, which leads some to wonder that the project was a failure. On the other hand, these 50 refugees came much sooner than expected. And today, a year shy of Syria calling, these refugees have arrived in Iceland.
Marijke and Jonas, tell us about what you've done.
Yes, thanks a lot for the invitation. We are also really happy to be here. We started Refugees Welcome, Flüchtlinge Willkommen, which is a digital platform to bring together refugees and local people in Germany and across Europe. And it's about a website, I would say. We launched this website in November 2014. So before this euphoric year of 2015, before everybody was talking about it and the media was covering it, so right before, and it was in the beginning just a private initiative because we had a spare room in our flat share in Berlin, and because Marijke was going for 6 months to work in Cairo, Egypt, and so we thought, okay, this is the first point where we can get active, because we were interested in the topic months ago, and we thought, okay, there are refugees in Germany, not only 50, there are more, as all of you know. But we were really unhappy with the way they were treated and the accommodation for them. So we decided, okay, this is the first point for us where we can get active.
Yes, and it was a crazy time because we started as a very private initiative of three voluntary lead people, Jonas, me, and Gorde. And after 2 days, we had like the first interviews for newspapers and media. And then it was the next year was crazy. Like, we had waves of attention, like waves where we got a lot of support from the media, which was also reflected then by the population and a lot of registrations for rooms on our website, but as well since October last year, also affected by the attack in Paris and then the things in Cologne. There was also a wave of a big skepticism and a big hate and skepticism towards refugees in general, which is also right now influencing our work. And so we grew as from a very small initiative of three people to 9 employees, which are working, most of them full-time, for this job, all financed by donations of private people, except of one funding. But as well, we got a lot of support from other countries, and we got a lot of emails and from people from other countries who heard from us through the media. And what we tried to do is to give them also the opportunity to build up this concept in their country. So since more than 1.5 years, Austria was the first country who adapted our concept and is also working with the same concept. And besides Austria, 10 other countries are working as a part of Refugees Welcome International, which is called, this is the name of our international network. So 11 other European countries and Canada, where we're also online. And we try to support each other, so we had so far 2 meetings where all these teams from other countries meet. The first in Athens, also because we wanted to learn about the situation in Greece. It was last November, and now in Warsaw in May, because the Polish team has a lot of, or has to fight a lot with the right-wing terrorism and attacks also in Poland. And we wanted to give a sign that we support this very, very good work of the team over there. And this was the second meeting. And maybe...
Just for the case you don't know the concept, it's about just bringing together on a website people who have a spare room and a flat share. Could be students, could be families. And on the other hand, refugees who are looking for a room to bring them out of mass accommodation or homelessness. And both parties can register on our website, and it's not automatically matching. It's getting to our database, and we're bringing the people together. So we see, or we try to find people who are sympathetic to each other and fit to each other, maybe have a similar background or something like this. Just to show, it's also really an experiment and a pilot like this, to show the government also that things like this are working easily. And this is what we experienced over the last 1.5 years. Till now we have 350 people matched in Germany to flat shares with locals, and about 750 in all the countries in our international network, so 12 countries at the moment, which is growing because this was never a German topic. It was always a European topic. And
And maybe a last sentence. So the core is really to live together. We never match to empty flats because we think the support comes from the people, and it's the most easy way and the most direct way to get active, just to give a spare room to someone who is really in need of it. And because in a mass accommodation and, of course, as well in homelessness, you can't live in dignity. And this is what we criticize and what we... would like to change. And any living together situation, even if it's a family or a couple, whatever, it's fine for us. And we think this makes it really easy for both parties to learn from each other.
Fantastic. Could you tell us a bit about your extraordinary journey and the work that you do in Coventry?
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. First of all, this morning I thought I'll be sitting on the other side, and then last night my colleague Alan Thomas rang me and he said, can you cover for me, because he's not well. So it just reminded me of my journey as a refugee, because I was living in Afghanistan with my family, and before I knew it, then I was in the back of a lorry en route to the UK with 50 other people, children and women and families. And when we arrived in the UK, we were accommodated for a night in one of the hostels. And in the morning, the Home Office officer arrived with an interpreter. For some, I might be repeating this story again. And she had a smile on her face. And she said, you lots will be sent to Coventry. And it took me 2 years to work out what that smile meant. I'm delighted to represent the City of Sanctuary this morning. So I'm a trustee of the National City of Sanctuary Group. City of Sanctuary started in year 2005 in Sheffield from a conversation between a leading Methodist and a local Quaker. It's a grassroots movement now in over 70 cities and other places and localities. City of Sanctuary is based on a vision of welcome and creating welcoming places and neighbourhoods, and also it's a network that promotes the idea of a culture of welcome. Wherever refugees go in our localities and neighbourhoods or cities or universities that have signed up the pledge for City of Sanctuary, they need to find that welcome, and we want them to feel safe and find people who welcome them. and support them, include them in their activities, and recognise and celebrate what they can contribute, and understand why they are here. Because we do hear quite a lot that people come here to take our housing, people come here to pose some kind of a threat to our identity, people come here to take our jobs. But at the end of the day, these people come here to seek protection, but also to rebuild their lives in safety and dignity. In April, I was in Istanbul, and I had an honour to speak to some of the refugee families as they were arriving from Syria. So I asked one family a question, and I said, what was it that made you leave Syria? And the response of the guy was... The safety of my children. And then I asked again, I said, what is the most important thing now about being in Istanbul? What do you like about Istanbul? And the response was the safety of my children. So these people, like anyone else, are running for the life of their children and their own safety. And I think anyone else, every one of us will do the same. If our children were not safe, we'll do something to get them to safety. So this is what we're trying to do, that we recognise their situation, but at the same time we create organisations, places and institutions where they're welcome and that they get the kind of support. And the best way to support and include refugees from our work is not to create separate services for them. But our work is to make sure that the existing services that we have for everyone are welcoming and accessible to refugees. We have examples of kind of work that we're doing, and it's mainly run by volunteers, such as providing English language lessons and improving maternity services for asylum-seeking women by supporting some of them to speak of their experiences to groups of midwives. But in overall, our work is around giving refugees the voice so they could tell their own story. Because unless we give this situation, or the crisis as they call it, a human face, people will still believe in what they hear through the media. People will still have their own perceptions. But unless people tell their own stories, and they could stand up and tell their own experiences and what they want to do and what they have to offer to this society, people will still contribute to what they get through, what they get fed through the media. So this is the work of the City of Sanctuary. We've got great examples of City of Sanctuary across the UK. In Oxford, in Coventry. In Coventry we've done some amazing work, mainly around the faith communities. When the first group of Syrians arrived, Coventry's taken over 200 Syrian refugees, which is more than any other cities in the UK. And I was proudly telling Jonas about 200 people in Coventry, and he's like, for us it's a big number, but for him it's a smaller number compared to what other cities across Europe has taken. But it's in a small way what we've achieved is we've done that through the support of faith communities. So the Bishop of Coventry played a hugely important role in encouraging the leadership of the council and the local area to welcome these refugees. And he went out of his way. When the first 50 or 60 Syrians arrived, he rang me, said, "What can I do for them, Sabir?" And I joked, I said, "Well, I can bring them to your house for dinner." And that joke turned into reality. And before we knew it, 60 Syrians were at the bishop's house, meeting all the different faith leaders in the city as well, because they're the most important thing that happened out of that that dinner, was that those Syrians realised that their challenge is not to live in a mono-faith, mono-cultural society, but how to live and set roots in a multicultural, multi-faith, diverse city such as Coventry. So there were different faith leaders, there were different... it wasn't just the bishop and his canons and advisors, but there were people from all the different communities. So those are kind of steps that we take to make sure that people get a realistic picture of setting up life in the UK. And I'll be happy to tell you more about it through the questions that Alex will be asking us. Thank you.
you. Before we get to Q&A from the audience, I just want to ask some questions. I mean, there's a lot there that I think we can all learn from. And I think it's crucial that while we have you here, we derive those lessons. So the first thing I want to ask you all is, what can we learn about how to mobilise civil society? In their different ways, all of these stories highlight that from very, very small beginnings, there's often a moment of takeoff, which leads to large-scale action, the inclusion and inspiration of many people. So what do you think the wider lessons are of how we achieve that? How do we encourage the public? How do we mobilise civil society? What comes from your stories? Brindish?
Mm-hmm. I must say, when I started this action, it was because I felt that it was naive enough to work. In my mind, it was clever to point out to the Minister of Social Affairs and Housing that Iceland had free rooms for more refugees, and she thought, I knew it was a naive point of view that Emma is going to cook for them and John has a spare room, not to mention that Anna teaches Icelandic. But it was also clever, because why not? Why is that not just helpful? I actually believe it is sometimes worth the while asking simple questions, because it demands straight answers that tend to be enlightening and revealing. They reveal how the system works and where it can be improved. I think we need to continue to ask these simple questions. Furthermore, it's important to write to mobilize the public. I was most surprised by the fact that what provoked most attention, even with the global media, was a simple enough text, very clear, very modest, in fact a trivial everyday description of life, where I believed myself to be expressing simple truths that everyone is familiar with. And that is the text you read earlier on refugees being human resources, experience and skills. Refugees are our future spouses, best friends, our next soulmate and so on, just like you said. People who will never be able to say to your life is worth less than mine. I believe this text to be true and familiar. It expresses something like the American dream. It simply says everyone should have the chance to live the life they want. As a writer, I have become attuned to how important it is to describe reality and everyday life. That is how we connect to each other. I think Syria Calling provoked so much attention because it sent a clear message without dictating what people were supposed to do, but rather offering them a chance to contribute according to their own resources. This clear message was also something that sparked a conversation and had political leverage. Last but not least, I learned how important it is to look for solutions and give voice those who have a positive outlook and want also to look for solutions. These voices are all too often drowned out by a minority of those who see everything as a problem and are threatened by even the smallest changes.
Jonas and Marijke, your model has been not only picked up by people in Germany but replicated across the whole of Europe. How did that happen, and what can we learn from that? If other people want to build something at that scale, what do they need to do?
I think what is so successful about the idea is that it's so clear and simple. We focused on living and not on giving language classes and so on. There is so much to do when people arrive in Germany or wherever, but we said, okay, it's just so, like in our case, it was just so easy. We had a spare room, we were unhappy with the situation of the government. We said, okay, the only thing what we can do is giving one person the possibility to live in our room. And I think for many people, it's a special form of activism. They don't need to give clothes or to give money or whatever. It's just they say, okay, I have a spare room. I'm living together all the time in flat shares, whatever. And now I give it to a refugee. It's just very simple and very clear.
Yeah, and I think, so that's also what I think. But I think it's also, or it was totally important for our idea and for spreading this idea, that it was simple on one hand, and to that we made it easy for the mainstream people to come into the topic, because we were not talking with like termina, with words that only people understand who are already inside the topic. We just made it clear and simple for all the people, so no one was excluded. But I also think it's important to also for the long term, for the future, to make people in Europe understand that Europe has an important role for the reasons why people are fleeing. I think this topic is too small everywhere. We should educate this in school and make conferences like this and weeks like this and talk about this, that I don't know, Great Britain, France, so the country at the moment who say no refugees, are only a small number, had a big role the last 100 years to make the situation like it is today, and to make things like they are in the global view, and to make reasons exist for people to flee. And I think we should also bring this thinking to more to the people, and also to the mainstream people, so not excluding the mainstream people but including them.
Yeah, and I think one way to reach all these people was to have this very simple looking website, where it's just, you have four steps. Okay, registering, we get in contact, we discuss how to finance the room, and then you will meet the refugee and he can move in or she can move in. And this is like, this is a very simple process about the idea, but as well for all the people, for all the other teams in the countries, we said the same. Connect to each other, build a team, find out how it's working in your country, and then we will support you with the website, the idea, blah, 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 and then you can go online. So no long research, no long discussions, just doing and believing in what you're doing. And it's just
being
about
naive. Yeah.
This is what you said. Just like doing and not too much think about it.
And Sophia, City of Sanctuary, why has it taken off? What's been successful? What can we take from it?
I think we believe at the human level people are basically sympathetic towards those who have suffered trauma. So that is kind of like our kind of understanding. However, we also know that most people would listen to or contribute to what they get fed through the media. And I think usually it's human instinct. We want to help one another. We want to be supportive. We're understanding. But nothing creates support for refugees than these terrorist attacks, and several in a year. So sometimes people might kind of like change their views about refugees because of a different context. So last year, September, we all came out and we were flying these banners, refugees welcome here, and then Jeremy Corbyn was appointed as the leader. He went to the to these rallies, and those people who were supportive of Jeremy Corbyn, then they will support refugees, and those that were not supportive of him, although they were supportive of refugees, they will not support them because he was supporting that. And so in a way, I think is how I think our work is, what we do is we work towards a tipping point. So the idea is quite realistic in certain in institutions, especially those based on ideal of open access for professional standards of universal service, such as schools, health, and universities. So what we've done is we've kind of like approached those institutions. So Coventry City Council, after Sheffield and Leeds, was the third city that became a city of sanctuary. So the city pledged to do something, to take an extra step to help and welcome refugees. I think it's the idea of making sure that we don't contribute to the negative only, but how can we make sure that the services that we've got for everyone, they're welcoming to refugees as well. I think we also have learned that individuals and organisations can be moved from ignorance to passive sympathy and active support as well. So it's kind of like giving people that kind of a journey. So, for example, if we want a school to become a school of sanctuary, we've got a guidance for it. So There's certain steps that need to be followed to become a school of sanctuary. There's certain steps to be followed to become a theatre of sanctuary. There's certain guidances to become a council or local parish of sanctuary. So those are the kind of, I think that simplicity plays a role. You need to give people that kind of guidance, and I think what we've done is over the years we've developed those kind of support packages where people know what to do to become a place of sanctuary. And then I think the other concept was also that there are areas that are used to welcoming refugees. They've got many years of experience of welcoming refugees, but there are others who are not too sure, but they want to do something. So the clear example in the UK is Malvern. So in Malvern, the local public wanted to take refugees, and the councils were not too sure about it. So what we did was, as City of Sanctuary, we went and mobilised that group and the public, and we delivered talks to councillors, we delivered talks to politicians, with those members of the public. We got to a point where then Malvern said they will take 50 Syrian refugees. So it's kind of like doing it one step at a time. And that movement has worked, where the concept is even kind of like explored in other parts of Europe, so France, Germany, Holland, and I've been to places like Turkey as well, to see how we could develop, we could establish that culture of welcome and culture of volunteering. Mm-hmm. Not that you just physically give you a room to refugees, but how could you stand for them, and how could you kind of like give them that kind of voice? That, because usually people arrive, they don't have a voice. How could you be their voice? How could you stand? How could you give their plight a human face? And that has worked, and we've got 70 cities, towns and villages of sanctuary. There's even a pub of sanctuary, so people want to help. And I think once you get kind of like, it's just that kind of, once you get the list, then people would like to add to it. Yesterday I was meeting with a theatre in Coventry. They want to become a theatre of sanctuary. I think it's people then read about you and they know what they... And the situation and the crisis is there. But people want to help. Some of them don't know how to help. I think City of Sanctuary has filled that gap.
Really great set of reflections. I've got another question I want to ask, but I want to bring other people in. So what I suggest is that we perhaps take a collection of about 4 questions from the audience. I'll throw my question on the end, and then we'll come back to each of the panellists to respond. So let's start with that. We've got some specific questions for Marijke and Jonas about working with the government, about involving people who offer rooms in wider discussion. Then for all of you, I think we've got this theme of how do you make what you do sustainable? How do you sustain support beyond the immediate crisis, beyond the immediate visibility? And then I'd also like to add a question for all of you, which is a question of what should we all do next? These projects are inspiring individually, but how do we work collectively? What can we all do to build a Europe-wide social movement? What's the one thing you would like to see us do collectively? So perhaps let's start with Marijke and Jonas with the specific questions for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I collected 4 questions. One of them was how we do the financing of the rooms. So if we are dependent on payments of the government and so on, there are 3 ways how we finance rooms. So the first and easy way is if the room is rent-free. So if you own the house, you're not dependent on the rent. Some people are not, and they offer us the rooms rent-free. So this is the most easiest way. The second one is if you have a certain status in Germany, dependent on the country where you're from, so for most of them, they are from Syria, you get money from the government to finance your rent wherever you live. So this means this is the recognition as a refugee, whatever, I don't know in English. And this is a very... like the most comfortable status you can have. But this means as well you can choose where to live so far until we will have a next very bad law which will... whatever. But so far, if you have this status, we ask the the persons who have the room, how much is the rent? Okay, it's this level, and up to this level, the room can be financed by the government. And the third way is that, like in our case, we don't know, we didn't know about these possibilities. We just ask friends and families, okay, this is our plan. Would you support us with monthly 5 euros, 10 euros, 15 euros to finance our room? And within 1.5 weeks, we had enough money to finance this room. And we call this micro donations or micro fundings, whatever. And if this is not possible, if the flat share or family is not able to finance the whole rent through this way, we can also support them from a special bank account where we collect money only for the rents. These are the three options.
So another question was how or if we involve the people, the flat shares, into the topic of the global things who leading to people who make people flee or something. No, we don't, because for us it's for this for that moment enough that people offer their house, their rooms. So this is their role, and but we think that, so you have to see, for many people it's the first contact with the with people with a refugee background. So it's a new experience for both sides often, because there are many prejudices for both sides. So we can leave this, they can leave these prejudices on both sides, how I said. And I think this is the most important, to bring people together, locals and non-locals, because then that this is the point where people see, okay, the prejudice is wrong. So often, and I think that people get they only offer the room, but they get in touch with the reasons more and more, I think. And this is like naturally, automatically happening. So we don't have to teach them and educate them. It's more like we bring them in a situation, in contact, and maybe after some months they talk about the reasons for fleeing or something. We hope that it's not the first question, because yeah, this is never good, but yeah, we hope that they get involved in the topic and in the influence from European countries to other countries in other parts of the world, and think about this more than before.
Then there was the question how we get to the refugees. Like, if we only match refugees who are already in Germany, I think this was the question. So since, like, after 1 month after we started, we translated the website to Arabic. And since then, and also since then, we gave refugees the possibilities to register at our website. So both parties can register, people who have a room and people who are looking for a room. And we never had any problems to reach the refugees, actually. I think the website was transported through social media to the communities, whatever. I don't know. We don't know how, but we have 11,000 registrations from refugees, and in comparison to, I don't know, some thousands from people who have rooms. And we even had registrations from people who are still who were still in Libya or in Syria, who wrote us, "I heard about your project. Can you make me come to Germany?" And we said, "No, it's just only possible if you're already in Germany."
But there were some guys who were extra smart and registered when they haven't been to Germany, registered before, and so when they came to Germany, one guy told us that 2 weeks after he arrived in Germany, he had a phone call of us if he's looking for a room. He said yes, so this was like perfect flow, I would say.
And he was actually the same time in Egypt when I was in Egypt, but because he came from Somalia to Egypt and then took the boat to Italy, and then but he had already registered when he was in Egypt.
Okay, Samir, can I ask you how you think we can sustain support beyond the immediate crisis? How do we strive for sustainability?
I think the support will always kind of like fluctuate depending on situations, but what we need to do is to keep that pressure on. If it wasn't for the public pressure, the UK wouldn't have agreed to take 20,000 Syrian refugees. It was one picture, one image that changed everything. And people were out there putting pressure on the government until the Prime Minister came back and said, "We'll take 20,000 Syrians." So it has worked for us. It has worked for the grassroots. Let's keep that going. The other thing that I'd like to say is links between those involved in welcome and those involved in advocacy and lobbying. is very, very important. So if people are doing things at local level and there are others doing things at national level with the politicians, it's very important to keep that those connections. And I think stories as well. Stories, yeah, if Daily Mail can write a story, why shouldn't we write our stories? Why shouldn't we write a story about today? Why shouldn't we write stories about things that are happening in Germany and other places? So bringing that kind of grassroots journalism into it as well. So we tell these positive stories. During the Refugee Week, the Joint Council for the Welfare of Migrants is doing a campaign about positive stories of migration and others as well. Let's share them. Let's bring them to the attention of our politicians. Let's bring them to the attention of those that are not too sure and those that are in the middle ground. So, and the other thing is building a common cause. So with those supporting other disadvantaged groups as well. So bringing those movements together. And one thing that I've kind of like observed in the past year or so is this issue of deserving and non-deserving refugees. And I think it's very, very important that in our campaigns we do not separate or deal with the Syrian resettlement separately. No one will leave their home or no one will leave their friends and family unless their life was in danger. So every refugee's life counts, and it's very, very important that we fight for all of them, not just one group. But let's use the Syrian resettlement to make life easier for others as well. I think the question that was posed to colleagues around housing and how support can be sustained. We've got a great example in Coventry as well. The organisation that I'm involved in, Coventry Refugee and Migrant Centre, a couple of years ago we set up a supported housing service. And not because we were after any income, but because we had quite a lot of people who will be, in my kind of like terminology, positively destitute. So once they get their leave to remain, they've got 28 days to leave their support, the Home Office support, to move into mainstream support. So you've got your papers, but what has happened is that you're destitute. So we spoke to some private landlords who wanted to help refugees. So we started with one or two houses and we set them up as supported housing units. We now have about 45 supported housing units, and these all came from private landlords. We rent them to people to people who've been granted leave to remain, and the rent is paid through housing benefit. So the project makes a small surplus, and for that what we are doing is that we've allocated a number of units to destitute people who've got no access or no recourse to any public funds. So we want to make sure. But the problem again with our project is that it's 100% occupancy rate. So there might be situations where a lady with a child turns up one evening and you don't have any room. So for that we've set up a destitution fund where we could find a night shelter for a night using the funds from the destitution fund. So there are some other examples as well, but I thought just to give a bit of a reflection that that refugee integration, refugee support could also be an opportunity to it may not be just pressure on resources or services or funding. People want to help, as I said earlier, and other colleagues said the same thing. How can we turn that support and help into innovative ideas to reduce the pressure on services, but at the same time create a provision of housing, shelter and support for refugees? And that's what we've achieved in Coventry.
Fantastic. Finally, Brindish, what can we all do next?
Well, I believe in the importance of diversity of movements in social change, each of which has its own strategy. 7 years ago, I was involved in much more radical movements than the action I started last year, while working with asylum seekers mainly from Afghanistan on a much more personal level. I think that many radical movements are doing a good job, but I also think that it's important to create a more open and more general platform. It's also necessary to see the fight for the rights of refugees and asylum seekers as a part of a bigger project, including the rights of women, people with disabilities, LGBT people and the academia and so on. I believe that these different movements can cooperate, encouraging solidarity across different life experiences. So, in the end, every one of us is capable of supporting someone else, giving each other voice, although his or her situation is a bit or entirely different from ours. And that is how I think we can make this more sustainable.
Thank you. This has been a panel that I think has been really rich in ideas, inspiration, practical solutions. And I think all of our panelists have been remarkably generous in sharing their thoughts and their ideas. We're going to briefly before the break show a short film from the Red Cross. But before I just introduce that, I really want to say thank you so much to all four of you for getting the conference off to such a great start.